just quickly kind of give you some idea about what we've been up to. As you're not already aware, the tapes were made at the previous session, so if you're at all interested, you can go back and listen to those. And then maybe what we do today will make a little bit more sense. Today, 20th. Okay. All right. Today we're going to be talking about organizing the material that you're
the secretary.
You've been putting together material on for your article. But what I'd like to do is just get initially, we can start rolling the tape. Thank you. I'd like to put a list on the board of 10 basic types of. Okay. 10 basic. Can you see that at all?
No.
Very good.
Let me see if I can. Do I have a marker?
It's just a can.
That's Mr. Denver. Yeah. Well, he had a whole bunch of holy markers.
Yeah.
But maybe they weren't just in
them. Yeah, this is what I drew. They drew that because he had an injured, he had an abscess.
Oh,
his
no.
Burst.
Walking too much.
Okay. So I have a blue dot on the end of my nose. I just smelled this and it touched my nose. Okay. I'd like to put a basic list of the kinds of articles it's possible to write, or the ones you see most commonly in magazines and so on. And then we're going to go from there in terms of how you organize the material for each of these different kinds of articles as you're writing them. Okay? So number one would be the most common type is informational. An article that simply provides information about something. It can be information about a person, it can be information about how to separate your garbage, how to recycle, how to take care of your 1956 Ford pickup, you know, anything. And so all kinds of articles fit into this category. Second, how-to articles. There are people who do nothing, who make a good living writing how-to articles. Mm-hmm. You know, there are people who have syndicated columns that are how-to articles. There are people, you know, they write about auto mechanics, or they write about, what's her name, the woman who does...
Ann Landers.
Well, that's not exactly how-to.
How to solve your problems.
Yeah, well, that's true. It's how to solve your problems in your life. I was thinking of Hints from Heloise.
Yeah.
You know, basic how-to things.
Gardeners, of course.
Around the house, gardening articles, you name it. Yeah. Those are very popular. Okay. So if you know how to do some things that maybe the average run-of-the-mill person like myself might not know, why, you've got an article right there in your head.
How to use a word processor.
That's right. How to not be frightened when you buy your computer.
Yeah.
Okay. Three, profile articles. Okay, this is simply, these are very common and very popular. Profiles of people. And they can be celebrities, well-known people, or they can be total unknowns. You know, there's an article, I think, every month in Reader's Digest called My Most Unforgettable Character, something like that. Mm-hmm. And it's always a complete unknown. Somebody's grandmother or somebody's uncle or something. Okay, people are interesting. They don't have to be famous. Fourth, historical. We were saying the other day that there's a lot of writing being done now on the Oregon Trail because it's I don't know, 300th anniversary, 200th anniversary, whatever, mm-hmm. this year. People are interested in history. Personal experience articles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We don't tend to value our own personal experience very highly, but it's unique and it's interesting. And if we write about it in an interesting fashion, other people will find it interesting as well. In a minute, I'm going to read you. This is the only time I've done this all week. I think I've exercised admirable restraint. I'm going to read you an article that I wrote. That's a personal experience article, and that'll be what we'll kind of revolve one of our exercises around. inspirational. There's a tremendous market for inspirational articles. Now, inspirational does not mean sappy, pietistic, the kind of stuff that just, it's just purely for, personal, sappy, pietistic reasons, a truly inspirational article, that term correctly understood, is an article that makes you want to go on living. It gives you a new, it makes you feel more encouraged about simply getting out of bed every morning and going back to the same old job, that you have every other day of the year for the rest of your life, or until you retire or whatever. Or, dealing with, with retirement in a creative fashion. Any kind of article. Inspirational articles can be personal experience articles, they can be historical articles, they can be profiles, And inspirational, these categories sometimes will overlap with one another. Okay? It's easy to tell a historical article that's also inspirational. You can write a story about somebody who traveled the Oregon Trail and, the courage that they showed in confronting all the challenges that involved and so forth. That can be very inspirational. So don't misunderstand inspirational. Seventh, humor or satire. I'm going to read a little bit of humor or satire in a minute, too. And satire. Who knows the difference between humor and satire? How are they different?
Humor is anything that's funny, and satire generally makes fun of something to get at a point.
Okay, yeah. It's poking fun at something to make a point. Humor is just funny, a funny story, just about anything. Okay. Satire can be about a real person or a real event. Satire can be biting and harsh. It can be, there's such a thing as nasty satire. Satire that really is out to hurt somebody. Or ruin somebody's reputation or something like that. All right, eighth, travel. If you like to travel and you're willing to spend the time being gone a lot, if you really enjoy traveling, there's a big market out there for travel articles. There are people who do nothing but write travel articles and syndicate those to newspapers themselves. Okay, and there's always a big market for that. Nine, investigative. This is interesting. This is probably the most famous, at least in modern times, example of investigative reporting or articles would be the Woodward and Bernstein series that ran in the Washington Post during the Watergate period, for those of you who remember that. And the later book that they wrote, All the President's Men. That was investigative reporting. Don't try to get involved in this unless you have a lot of time to spend and don't plan to make much money at it. If you're only in it for idealistic purposes, then that can be worthwhile. 10, point of view articles. Okay, you simply want to state your point of view. The stuff that goes on the op-ed page in the newspaper or whatever it might be. Okay, this is your chance to be opinionated in public. Yes.
What's the difference between investigative and information?
Okay, informational can be simply information off the top of your head or stuff you looked up in the library. Investigative articles generally mean you have to go out and pound the pavement and dig up information about somebody that maybe is being concealed from the public. You try to get stuff using the Freedom of Information Act and that kind of thing. You're really trying to get the dirt on somebody, for example. Okay, any questions about any of these? Okay, now each one of these is going to have at least a slightly different approach in terms of organizing your period, gathering your material, organizing it, developing the outline for your article, and so on. And we can't go through all of them, unfortunately, because we don't have the time. But what I'd like to do is read this article that I wrote as an example of a personal experience, if I can find it. This was published in the last issue of Praying magazine, and is entitled Jesus on a Bicycle. Okay, it even incorporates a little humor, at least in the title, because when you think about that idea, Jesus on a bicycle, that's kind of amusing. All right. And actually what it is the story, in part at least, of how I happened to write this book. So it gives you a little insight into what it's like to be writing books. Okay, so if you will bear with me, this isn't too terribly long, and I will try to read it quickly, but articulately in such a manner that everybody can understand what I'm saying. Okay. In the spring of 1992, I signed a contract. Oh, wait. As I'm doing this, try to be aware of how I organized my material. Okay? Maybe make a note when you see me making a shift from one idea to another one, and see how I put it all together. Okay, see what you recognize about how it's organized and how my outline might have looked initially. In the spring of 1992, I signed a contract to write a book due by October. But this is the real world, Charlie, my boy. During June, July, and August, children stay home to bounce off the walls and their aging parents' fragile psyches. Ergo, the parent writer who plans to stay home during the summer and pummel the muse until she coughs up a book has another plan coming, as did I. Ho, I said to myself, a clever idea percolating in my brain, I will work in the empty basement bedroom at the home of my kind and generous in-laws who live but 5 miles away. Ho, ho, not only that, but I will commute by bicycle. Avoid the arterials and pedal shady tree-lined residential side streets to and fro. I will enjoy the ride, and the almost middle-aged cardiovascular system will get some of the attention it so richly deserves. I rode my 25-year-old three-speed bike to the bicycle shop, where row upon row of gleaming new 10-speed and 21-speed mountain bikes and racing bikes smirked in my direction. Smirked as I pushed my trusty, rusty old Murray Navajo through the front door. The guy in the service department was more polite, although I saw a tiny gleam of pity in his eye. He filled out the ticket, two new tires, true the wheels, replace the brake pads and adjust the brakes, lubricate the chain, check the gear cable, and clean off as much of the rust and oily grime as possible. Will that be all, sir? While Friend Bicycle got a new lease on life, I shopped around and bought a white bicycle helmet from a discount store. Nothing fancy, but it would serve. When I tried on my helmet the first time and looked in the mirror, I felt ridiculous. If my childhood self could see me now. Memory conjured up the bike I got for Christmas when I was 8 years old. It was a heavy old Sears and Roebuck job, red and black, with fat, white sidewalled tires and a tank fitted to the crossbars, built into which was a battery-powered horn that croaked, "Blat!" when you pushed the button on the right-hand side of the tank. It had a headlight mounted on the front fender, a big red reflector on the back fender, and there was no such thing as a bicycle helmet. Bicycle safety meant using hand signals before turning, and if you crashed into a car or fell off your bike and cracked your head open, it was because you were stupid. A week later, the bike repair guy wheeled out my old Murray from the back room, and I swear it looked almost new. Its chrome fender sparkled. Had to replace a couple of broken spokes in the rear wheel, too, the bike repair guy said. That'll be $85 plus tax. I pushed aside the thought that for $115 more, I could have bought a new, bottom-of-the-line, 21-speed mountain bike from among the ones that still smirked in my direction. Riding 5 miles to my in-laws' home in the morning and 5 miles home again in the afternoon became a spiritual experience. My legs were not used to this sort of thing. Ordinary walking around and climbing the occasional flight of stairs is all I typically asked of what my grandfather called his pins. Now they and my startled feet made pedals go around and around, around and around, while the new tires whizzed over the asphalt streets. My calves and things grew stiff. Whoa, my spirit exclaimed, not without sarcasm. We have a body, do we? My, my. The book contract I signed required me to produce between 50,000 and 60,000 words about basic religious truths I first learned as a boy in Catholic schools and how my understanding of those ideas changed and developed as I grew to my present ripe maturity. Riding a bicycle 10 miles a day contributed as much to the book as did my mind and my fingers as they went tappity-tap on the keyboard. Writing the book became, God help me, a holistic experience. My morning and afternoon rides gave my physiology attention it appreciated. My physiology said distinctly one morning as I sped along, I appreciate this. Thus attended to, my body welcomed the demands I made on my mind, and my mind encouraged me to take time for prayer. My average summer day looked like this. Ride bike 5 miles to home of in-laws, and descend to basement father-in-law calls Black Hole of Calcutta. Pray for a few minutes, write until noon. Pause for sack lunch or cycle to nearby shopping center for lunch with mutual biker friend Bob. Back to riding until 3 or 4 o'clock. Bike 5 miles home again. Sweat and feel virtuous for exercising and getting 1 5,000-word chapter done per week along with the occasional short article. If I didn't pray before riding, the riding did not go well. If I drove a car instead of biking, as I did wimp-like on a couple of days when it rained, the riding did not go well. Body and soul wanted their due before they would allow the spirit to express itself freely on ye old computer screen. Riding home one sunny, hot June afternoon, a cool breeze blowing in my face and through the elongated holes in my discount helmet, an idea slipped up on me, uncalled for. I bet if Jesus was alive today, right here in River City, he'd ride a bike. Jesus on a bicycle. Ha! I laughed right out loud, and a little girl standing in front of her house in a sagging swimming suit, playing with a streaming garden hose, looked at me wide-eyed, dropped the hose, and ran inside. There is considerable talk these days about images of God and or images of Jesus. Matthew's Gospel proffers Jesus as the new Moses. Liberation theologians suggest a Jesus who liberates politically and economically. Fundamentalists call upon a personal savior Jesus. So, why not a whimsical image too? One of Jesus on a bicycle. Picture Jesus on a well-used bicycle, one with 5 or 10 speeds, battered bicycle helmet on his head, riding, rainbow shades protect his eyes from dust and airborne insects. Jesus rides like the wind. Better, he rides with the wind, which bloweth where it listeth, if you know what I mean. Jesus on a bicycle calls for freedom of body, mind, and spirit. He would have us celebrate the human body as long as health and age permit, not abuse it or let it degenerate before its time. Jesus on a bicycle would call us to enjoy being embodied spirits and to fly to the aid of our fellow man and woman as they spin through life, on bikes or off. Okay, now. That was obviously a personal experience article.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But what else was it?
Inspirational.
Okay.
Inspirational.
Maybe. What else?
Humor.
Humor.
It was, it had a little humor in it.
Yeah.
Where do you go? Right, humor. Okay. What else?
Travel.
Travel. Sure did travel.
Maybe it would fit into the travel. This a bike magazine might like it. I don't know.
Point of view.
A point of view? Sure. Yeah.
There's humor in it, too.
Yeah, okay, I mentioned humor.
That's some informational here, like knowledge of theology and stuff.
Okay, okay, yeah.
A little bit of historical, bringing Jesus into it.
Right, and my childhood. Okay, anything else?
It's a how-to.
In what sense?
Well, how to get something done, you know, with in your own in your way of thinking.
Yeah, yeah. Well, not only that, but if you were paying close attention, I also explained in there that I managed to write a 60,000-word book
right.
by breaking it down into small units.
Right.
I said, okay, if I write 1,000 words a day, that's only 5 double-spaced pages a day. Okay, 5 days a week for 3 months, I've got a book. You know, I mean, you think to yourself, 50 to 60,000 words. Oh, no, I can't possibly do that. You know, but if you break it down into a little manageable, and I knew that, see, sometimes I'd finish that 1,000 words by noon, and I could do whatever I wanted to the rest of the day, because I knew I didn't have to keep push. You know, I knew that if I did that a little bit each day, 5 days a week, that I'd have it done by the time the summer was over. So I didn't have to sweat. If I finish my 1,000 words, you know, by noon, I could enjoy the rest of the day, do whatever I wanted to. Write articles like that one, which is what I did. You know, I was almost done with the book when I wrote that article.
You picked the title. You
I
said
did.
Sometimes.
No, I did. In this case,
that seems so obvious.
Yeah, in this case, I picked the title.
Yeah.
One of the few times that they left my title alone.
For a while, it was hard to tell which is the real subject of the article, you or the bicycle.
Yeah.
Of course, it's your experience.
Right.
And then all of a sudden comes this person with Jesus on
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
Boy, that really stuns you a little
bit. Yeah. Okay, let's analyze that a little bit. We talked earlier in the week about research. What kind of research did I do to write that article?
We need to know something about bicycles, I suppose.
Well, yeah.
To but where did I get money into it? You're going to find out something about it.
But where did I get all the information that's in that article?
From your personal experience.
Yeah, exactly. I did the research by thinking about what had been going on in my life at this particular time. Mm-hmm. You know, and I simply described some events and injected a little bit of humor in there in terms of, you know, as I pushed my clunky old bike in there and saw all those brand new gleaming bicycles, I could imagine in my mind, you know, that these bikes, if they were conscious, aware, sentient beings, you know, that they would look down their bicycle noses at me as I came in the door. Okay, so that's being creative and using a little bit of imagination in order to make the article interesting to the reader. You know, that could have been a deadly dull and boring article. Maybe it was anyway, in part, I don't know. Some people might go to sleep reading that article. You know? But, okay, so that's how I did my research. How do you suppose I went about organizing the material in order to write, to get it into the order I wanted it to be in? What was it, basically?
Well, I guess first you had the
purpose
and then the problem.
Okay. What was the purpose and what was the problem?
Okay, the purpose was to get the book done.
Okay.
But the problem was that you weren't going to be able to do it with your kids at home during the summer.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah. So the basic, here's the conflict, how do I resolve it, kind of thing. Yeah. Did you want to say something else, sir?
No.
Oh, okay. And so I organized the material. Essentially, it's chronological.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just said, first this happened, then this happened, then this happened. And that's how my, you know, and I put little asides in occasionally, you know, flashback recollection type things. Just asides or observations about other things, you know. But essentially, it follows a chronological structure. And that's all, so that was very simple to do. It was not a problem. And I didn't have to make a lot of notes. I simply sat down and wrote that one afternoon, literally. You know, it took me a couple of hours. So it was not a complex kind of process at all. But I did it all in my head, okay? And ordinarily we can't. Only when we're writing that kind of an article can you do that, you know? And even then, I had to kind of outline and organize in my head as I was going. You know, and
did you write a query letter to this publisher before you?
No. In this case, if you look in the back, you'll see that I am a book review columnist for this magazine. And so they already know me, and I just sent it to them and said, you suppose you could use this sometime? And they said, sure. But nevertheless, in this case, where you write something like this, where it is a personal experience kind of thing, it's kind of hard to write a query letter about an article like this. Mm-hmm. You know, and maybe it's better to just write it and ship it off, you know, as an article. It's not that you should never do that by any means, because sometimes it's the best way to handle it. Okay, alright, let us move along here and talk. I want to talk a little bit about the process of organizing the material once you've got it together. Once you've done your research, you've done your interviews, you've been to the library, you know, whatever it is you're going to do, you know, for your article, whatever kind it may be, how do you organize it if you're going to do it in such a fashion that it's actually going to make your job easier rather than more difficult? And I'd like to suggest steps that you can use in doing this, okay? First thing to do is to ask yourself a question. And the question is, what is your central message and how do you intend to document it? Okay? You should be able to sit down and just in longhand or on your typewriter, your computer, or whatever, and write out the central idea that you want to get across in writing this article. Okay? This is the main point that I want to make in writing this piece. Okay? Then below that, you should be able to say to yourself, and this is how I intend to support my point, or document my point, or provide provide whatever evidence I need to in order to bolster my argument and make it credible to the reader. Okay, so that it's more than just my opinion. Now, if I'm writing an op-ed piece, if I'm writing a point of view piece, then it can still be helpful to have other people's, an expert or two maybe to quote. And an expert can simply be somebody who has had some personal experience with the issue that I'm writing about, in case I haven't had that experience. If I have, that's all the better. Okay? All right. Once I know that, then I can start putting together my actual process of organizing material. Okay? I suggest that the first step should be to think of a title. Again, it may end up, when the article is published, it may not end up with this title at all. But once you have thought up a title, that helps you to even more succinctly focus the material. Okay, as you're writing. Once you've got a title, I often will, sometimes I don't do this, but often I will. I'll know, okay, I'm going to write an article about, the production of widgets in Tibet or something. But the thing is, I have to get it down to a more manageable size. So I'll have to make it something like, the conditions that the employees live under who make widgets in Tibet. You know, their living conditions. Did anybody happen to see a few weeks ago, there was a television program, news piece, about Nike shoes being manufactured in, Indonesia, I think? You know, almost all Nike shoes are manufactured in Indonesia, and the people are made to live in these little dormitory-like places, and they're paid $1.50 a day or something to make these shoes and all that, you know? They had to narrow it down. You know, they couldn't just say, well, we're going to talk about the manufacturing of shoes, you know, in Indonesia. No, they focused it down to the conditions that the employees live with, and in order to make it more manageable for us to get a hold of better. And the same thing happens when you're writing an article. And thinking of a title helps you to do that. Okay, and the title has to be specific too. Don't just say, the title of my article is Making Widgets in Tibet. Not good enough. Way too general. Okay, make it much more specific. Okay, the lifestyle of the people who make widgets in Tibet. You could even make it more specific than that, probably. The home life of people who make widgets in Tibet. The home life of people who have children who make widgets in Tibet. You know? Narrow it down. The more precise and limited you can make it, the better off you're going to be, because you'll have more control over your material that way. That way, anything that you've got that doesn't relate to people who are parents who make widgets in Tibet, you can throw it out, or else use it just really briefly in passing. All right? Second, once you've got your title, write down the main ideas or points that will sustain and document your title. Okay? Write down the main ideas or points that you're going to make. Okay? And maybe you've got such a limited amount of space to work with, since you know this magazine won't publish an article over 1,000 words, that you're going to have to stick to the biggies and not use some of the smaller, but maybe perhaps interesting points that you come across in your research on this topic. Okay, you'll say something like, well, I'm going to talk about how much money they make, and I'm going to talk about the living conditions that they have, and I'm going to talk about how many hours they work in a day. And everything else that I'm going to put in there is going to be related in some way to those three or four points that I'm making. Okay? And if I come across other things, then I may have to rethink what I'm going to do if I'm going to include those things as well. All right. We can put two parts to this, actually. Outline in detail what you want to say, okay, as a part of this process. A lot of people, a lot of writers, will use 3x5 cards. Okay? Okay, one idea per card. Okay, that fits under the four main ideas. Okay, and keep them in three different piles. And these are the ideas that fit for them for each of these four main ideas, after you've got them written down there. Okay, and secondly, okay, that's if you're doing it in detail. If you want to have a really detailed, and the more detailed you are in your outline, the more control you're going to have over your material to put into your article. It is, however, possible that if you don't feel like you need that much control, like if it's something you already have a lot of knowledge about yourself anyhow, or a lot of experience with, then you can use a short, informal outline. It might amount to nothing, informal. It might amount to nothing more than a short paragraph that you write for yourself, telling yourself what you're going to say here, and maybe a statement of what you're not going to say. Something like that. All right? Third step, write your first draft. Write the first draft. I find it helpful to do this quickly. Okay, just start in and bang, go through it from beginning to end and finish it. Okay? Not worrying about misspellings or bad grammar or bad sentence structure or anything. Just getting the whole thing out there on the page or in the computer or whatever, and there you are. Okay, now I've basically got the whole thing out there. Now I can go back. Okay, there are other people who agonize over every sentence as they go along, you know? I'm going to write this sentence, then I'm going to go back, and is that really how I want to say that? And as soon as that sentence looks the way they want it, then they move on to, or by the paragraph. As soon as that paragraph looks the way I want it, then I'll move on to the next paragraph. Okay? I find it more helpful to kind of do what a teacher of mine in college called the dump truck routine, you know? You back up to the thing and dump. And then you go back and sort it out. And the nice thing about word processors is you can move your paragraphs around, your sentences, and all that stuff, and it's real easy to do, which is great. You know, I guess 12 years ago, bought my first computer, I cut my production time in half. You know, it used to take me twice as long from beginning to end to get an article in the mail. And when you're working as a freelance writer, that means a lot to cut your production time in half. Okay. So if you're debating about whether to buy a computer or not, you might think about that. Now, there are people who make a nice little income on the side, you know, as freelance writers. It's not even their main line of work, but they do it on the side. You know, I've talked earlier in the week, I talked about Mary Higgins Clark, who writes suspense novels, and very lucratively. You know, her last contract was for $35 million. She started out writing. She'd get up in the morning at 5 o'clock. She raised 5 kids by herself. Her husband died in the early 60s. She had 5 kids. And she would get up, and she had a regular job that she had to go to during the day. But she would get up and write for 2 hours, between 5 and 7 a.m. every morning. That's how she wrote her first novel. You know, and everything since then has been history. You know? Now, of course, she doesn't have to do that. But if you're going to write, those are the kinds of choices you have to make. You know, it means this much to me that I'm willing to make the time to do it. To get up for early in the morning, or I'm going to stay up later at night after everybody else has gone to bed. Or I'm going to carve out, you know, a half an hour or an hour or whatever I can every day, and I'm going to never do anything but write during that time. You know, and if you're willing to do that, then you're really saying something about how seriously you're taking this whole thing. You know, and if you aren't able to do that, then maybe you're not that serious about it. Which is okay too. It's one way to find out if you're really meant to do this or not. You know, so I think if you're going to write, in a way, there's nothing that's going to keep you from writing in one form or another. And if there's anything the world needs more of, it's more good writers. Okay. Finally, number four, sorry, this isn't finally, rewrite. I think I used the quotation already earlier in the week, all writing is rewriting. There is no such thing as sitting down and doing it, you know, that article that I read to you went through 4 rewrites. Now, at one time, the little piece about the little girl with the hose was much earlier in the article. I moved it back. Didn't fit where it was originally. Okay, our minds don't work in a very organized fashion. You know, but once we get it out on the paper or the screen, why, we can move it or move things around and put them in an order that makes sense. Okay, actually, it was a little longer too. And I cut. You know, a lot of rewriting involves cutting. You know, look at that paragraph and say, that's a great paragraph, that's a wonderful paragraph, but it doesn't belong in this article. Mm-hmm. You know, and it hurts to have to tear that out and throw it away because he did such a great job on it, you know, but it just doesn't fit, or it's redundant. You know, I already said that. Yeah, I got to get rid of either this one or that one. Which one's it going to be? Mm-hmm. You know, the temptation to repeat ourselves in writing is very, very great. You know, one of the keys to the characteristics of a good article that's going to hold a reader's attention is that every new sentence adds something new to what the reader is getting here. We're not repeating ourselves unnecessarily. Okay, each paragraph is another step forward. It's not just kind of spinning our gears, you know, sitting in one place, going over and over the same idea from different directions. It doesn't make any sense. Okay, so that's an important thing to keep in mind in terms of rewriting and cutting. Any article, that article there, I could take that article if an editor told me to. If the editor had said, great article, but it's got to be half as long. Okay, I would have to have sat down and gone through there, and I could do it. I could cut that article in half, and it would still be a good article. It would still be a publishable article. There'd be stuff in there that wasn't, you know, but you can still do it. And it's important to learn to cut your own stuff, because if you let editors do it, you might not like what they do. It's your article, you do the cutting. That's my philosophy, whenever possible anyway. Okay, finally, what I call massaging the article. Okay, massage it, or polish it. You go through and you listen to each one of your words. Now, I often will read it aloud to myself. Say, this is okay. Yeah, it'd be better if I move these two words around here. You know, something. Does it really go smoothly? Does it really read in a way that is going to be entertaining? You know, you have to be an entertainer at the same time very often when you're writing, or you're not going to hold a reader's attention. Are these sentences, is this sentence too long? Can I break it in half and make 2 sentences out of it? Is this paragraph too long? Or maybe it's too short. Maybe I should join these sentences with the next paragraph, you know, because that's really where they belong. Are there words in here that are unnecessary? We tend to use words that are unnecessary a lot. You know, we tend, unfortunately, to write like we talk. And that's not a good habit to get into. You know, we should have a speaking style and a writing style. And whereas in speaking, we can use lots of unnecessary words just for the sake of, you know, our speaking style, or being, it's just the way we talk. For instance, an example is the word very. 9 out of 10 times, that word is not necessary and we should get rid of it. Okay, now it's a word in the English language, obviously, and it's a useful word at times. But 9 times out of 10, we can get rid of it and the meaning that we're trying to convey will not suffer at all. Okay, another one is really. You know, really. He was really angry. He was very angry. Well, usually you can just say he was angry, and you get your meaning across perfectly well. Okay, and unless there's some kind of a contrast you're trying to make between two people who are angry. He was angry and she was really angry. You know, or something like that, then that's understandable. But there are endless ways of doing this massaging process that I'm talking about here. And ultimately what it comes down to is your personal writing style. How do you write? You don't write like me, I don't write like you, and none of you write like anybody else in this room. You know, P.G. Wodehouse did not write like James Thurber. G.K. Chesterton did not write like Martin Luther. You know, our historical, you read a newspaper from the 1800s, and see how they wrote in those days, or a magazine article from the early, from the 1920s, and compare it with a magazine article. See a magazine that's been around for all that time. I don't know what. What's a magazine that's been around for since the 1920s?
Harper's,
maybe. Yeah. You know, read a Harper's article from 1926 and then read one from 1993. You know, it's just a whole different approach. And the same thing is true of people. We write in a different way. Okay, generally speaking, some good principles to keep in mind are a sentence is better shorter than longer. Okay? And two short words are better than one long one. Okay, so we all know that you know the meaning of I don't know, some complicated word. Okay, maybe you went to school and studied theology and you know the meaning of, gee, it's been so long. I haven't used these lately. You know the meaning of eschatological. Okay, so don't try to impress your reader with the fact by using that word, because it's a technical theological term. Instead, you break it down into a couple of simple, or two or three simple words. Okay, the study of the end time, you know, or however you want to put it in your article. Okay, people generally are not impressed by a writer who's trying to impress them with their vocabulary or their knowledge of technical language. Now, this is especially true, for instance, say you're writing a healthcare article for a popular audience, and you're an MD or a nurse or somebody with a knowledge of technical medical terminology. That's great when you're writing for your peers in the profession, but you can't do that when you're writing for an ordinary, you know, folks like me out there, and you know, you can't do that. You know, instead of calling, I don't know, sibling is a word that has become a lot more common, I guess. But there was a time when sibling was a very, you know, kind of, you only heard that when you were talking to a psychologist or somebody like that. You know, and still I tend to, I'll say brothers and sisters rather than sibling, usually. Because, I don't know, sibling sounds so, I don't know, technical or something, you know, impersonal. Okay. All right, any questions about any of this stuff? Here.
In your article, you pay so much attention to detail. And that kind of makes it more alive. You know, you talk about your bike and you talk about the little girl. And mm-hmm. Is that something that you did your draft and you wrote it and then you looked at it? Well, it means it would be more interesting if I put in more detail, or is that just kind of how you write with that?
In this case, it was kind of how I wrote, but often, if I'm writing a long profile article, for example, a number of years ago, I wrote a profile of Tommy DePaola. Okay, I think I mentioned that already, the children's author and illustrator. And I needed details, colorful details in it, and it was especially difficult because I didn't meet with him face to face. I called him on the phone. He lives in Vermont or New Hampshire, someplace like that. And yet I needed to get that in there for the reader. Here's a little trick you might want to keep in mind when it comes to doing profiles of people that you interview over the phone. Without actually saying so, and without lying to the reader, you can make it seem as if you in fact were right there in the room with that person. You know, I asked Tommy DePaola and then Mary Higgins Clark, when I talked to her on the phone, said, describe for me the room that you're sitting in right now. You know, and Mary Higgins Clark said, well, I'm on the fifth floor of an apartment overlooking Central Park East, or whatever it is she lives, you know, with a drop-dead view of the park. That was the phrase she used. That her apartment has a drop-dead view of the park. That was great, you know. I had to take her going. So I used her, I put that in quotation marks. You know, she said that she lives in an apartment with a drop-dead view of the park. And she told me about the carpet on the floor and what the curtains looked like and how she was dressed and all this stuff. And I took her word for it, you know, and I could put that stuff in there, and you'd swear to read that article that I was right there in her apartment in Manhattan interviewing her, but I didn't say that. In no time did I say that I was there interviewing her. But it makes it so much more interesting, and there's so much more immediacy for the reader when you say stuff like that. You know, and she told me how big the picture window was that she could look out to see the park. And so it's a neat little trick, you know, to keep in mind. But But it's good to put in the colorful little details, you know, when you can. Keeping in mind, you got to stay within the length of the article that you have to use. And sometimes if there are photos running with the article, for instance, the publishers or the editors of the magazine that are publishing my piece on Mary Higgins Clark, she was in town doing a book signing because her new novel had just come out. So they sent a photographer out there and they've got pictures of her and so on. So I didn't have to describe her physical appearance all that much because they're going to have photos of her. So I could cut back on the number of words I was using in that respect. But they don't have pictures of her in her apartment in Manhattan, so I could spend some time on that.
Yeah. If you're, for instance, if you're writing about, like you said, the working conditions of the people in Tibet making widgets.
Yeah.
I don't know, I guess I would be inclined to, at the beginning of the article, preface it with why is this company there? Mm-hmm. I mean, give a little historical, how Nike got to be situated there.
Yeah.
And then another thing, when you get, I guess I would, when I got to the end of the article, where you have Massagit, maybe the purpose of your article is to write about a human condition. Mm-hmm. I would probably put in a short moral statement at the very end.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah, no, that's, you know, a lot of that is personal style. If I were doing it, I would hold off on explaining why Nike is in Indonesia mm-hmm. until maybe somewhere towards the middle of the article.
Yeah.
You know? And start off, if I were sent to do an article about that, if they flew me to Indonesia or wherever they are, you know, my inclination, of just off the top of my head here, would be to tell the story by describing a typical day in the life of one of the people who work making shoes for Nike in Indonesia. And just follow them through the day and describe what they do from the minute they get up until they go to bed. And then interspersed throughout the article, I would put in material explaining why Nike is in Indonesia instead of Denver, you know, or something like that. And then at the end, you know, you could put in your observation, your personal, you know, observation about the situation or whatever you wanted to do. So, for sure. If you start putting in the information about why Nike is in Tibet or Indonesia right at the beginning of the article, it might not be as much of a grabber for the reader as it is if you focus on a person right away and say that this person gets up every morning at 3:30 a.m. you know, feeds her children and blah blah blah. You know, it's very personal that way, you know. A company isn't very personal.
Yeah.
But it's good, absolutely necessary to get that information in the article though, for sure.
I get when I read an article sometimes they'll write a reporter or somebody will write, an investigative reporter in many cases will write in a newspaper or a magazine an article on a certain organization, mm-hmm. political or something otherwise. Then by the time I get to the fifth or sixth paragraph, I guess maybe the editor does this, he abbreviates it with initials. And I've lost the name of the organization that they're talking about.
Oh,
and I have to go back. I really get turned off on those.
Yeah.
You know, GDL or whatever the organization
yeah.
is.
Yeah.
I get really discouraged. I have to go back and figure out. No,
especially if there's several of them.
Yeah, what is this thing? What is this outfit called again? And then mm-hmm. I have to go back and search.
Yeah. Okay, let me read. Are any of you familiar with The Door magazine?
No.
This is the only, as far as I know, the only successful religious humor magazine published in this country. And I think it's Lutheran, although there's sort of some fringy Dutch Lutherans, I think. But that's what it is. It's just hilarious. You know, if you don't have any problem with laughing at yourself, you know, which some religious people have a tough time laughing at themselves when it comes to religion. And I think that's unfortunate because I love to laugh at myself when it comes to this stuff. Otherwise, I feel like I'm taking religion too seriously. Religion is not God. God is God. So therefore, there should be a little room to laugh at ourselves. I wanted to read just a short piece in here before we have to quit. The guy who wrote this, and this is very creative, he said, what if various modern, you know, contemporary writers were the ones writing the gospel today, writing down gospels? And he said, well, And he's got Garrison Keillor, Ann Landers, Stephen King, Woody Allen, C.S. Lewis, P.G. Wodehouse, Tom Clancy, you know. Okay, and he imitates their style in writing the gospel. And I thought Woody Allen's was pretty good. So if you can, I guarantee this, you know, if you can write humor, you can make a lot of money. Because it is so difficult, and yet it is so much in demand. You know, if you can write humor, you've got it made. Anyway, this is how Woody Allen would write if you were writing a gospel. The sun rose on the strange sight of a reformed prostitute carrying a salami. She had gone to the market for burial spices, but had inexplicably been talked into a salami. What a putz I am, Mary thought. I could have at least gotten knockwurst. Or maybe corned beef on rye would be more appropriate. Entering the garden, Mary approached the tomb with apprehension. Cemeteries held painful memories for her ever since her Uncle Levi had become convinced he was a headstone. He left one day to have his hat blocked, and they found him 2 days later standing over a newly dug grave with Metzenbaum, 46 B.C. to 23 A.D., tattooed on his chest. They could only keep him at home by turning over fresh dirt in the garden every week. She was surprised and dismayed to discover the grave open and empty, with no sign of the Roman soldiers who had been posted to guard it. She decided she was going to insist the owner prorate the fees and ask for the deposit back. She'd been sure to read the contract carefully, especially after what had happened to her cousin. He paid for a plot for his father, only to discover later that the contract had been for a timeshare sepulcher. He only got 2 weeks a year, and they never left enough towels. Anyway, I love this stuff. So I hope you can write humor and become wealthy doing so. All right, well, I'd like to give you your last opportunity here in the last 5 minutes. If you have any questions about anything having to do with writing, nonfiction, for publication, fire away. You got 5 minutes.
That was just an observation. When you wrote Christ, Jesus on the Bicycle, it comes across that you were doing a lot of laughing during that.
I was smiling, chuckling to myself down there in the basement.
Just the title, you know.
And
it seems to me that...
Yeah. Well, it originated, it really did, when I was riding home one day, you know, and the little girl with the bike, or with the hose, you know, actually happened. And it occurred to me that, why not? And I began to just kind of turn over that idea in my mind of Jesus riding a bicycle.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and it was amusing at the time, yes. Okay. Any questions?
Do you have any tips in that article you wrote? You had a smooth transition from talking about your bike riding and how a spiritual impact on you, and then to the Jesus riding the bike. I mean, those were real, they were definite transitions, but they were smooth. Do you have any tips on how you...
Writing good transitions, I think it's something you just kind of have to develop a feel for it. And basically a transition has got to include both the idea you're finishing up with and the one you're about to begin with. And that it just, I don't know what to say except that you just have to, a good transition doesn't hit you over the head with the fact that you're making a transition. You don't write a sentence that says, and now I'm going to talk about, you know, whatever I'm moving on to next. It's very much of a stylistic thing, too. You know, that little piece I just read, there are transitions in there, you know, if you're paying close attention.
Yes. You outlined how you would go about writing an article. How about a novel? How do you focus in on, let's say you wanted to write a novel. What do you have to do? Think of a story? Or?
Well, I can't speak to that very well because I've never written a novel.
Oh, I see.
I'm not a fiction writer. I have written a few short stories. But my understanding is that the way people go about writing novels is as different from one person to the next as you know, their looks are. Some people will sit down and very laboriously design an outline of how it's going to go from beginning to end. I understand, I've read that the Stephen King just sits down and starts writing, you know, and sees where it goes, and when it ends, it ends. Charles Dickens worked that way. He just wrote. He didn't come up with outlines first. Although he had a basic, I shouldn't say that. In some cases he did, in fact, have outlines. I'm just thinking about this. But in other cases he didn't. And he always would go back and revise and rewrite. So they've got, you know, the original manuscripts of his stuff. But he would have a general, kind of the informal outline that I talked about before. He didn't do it in detail. So there's a computer program you can buy that's supposed to teach you how to write fiction. And I got the thing because they sent it to me for nothing in hopes I would review it somewhere. And I ended up being very kind of impatient with it. But there are lots, I mean, there are workshops around and there are books you can find. You know, if you subscribe to Writer's Digest, they have a whole line of books that are designed to help a person learn how to write fiction. But I'm afraid I can't be much help, personally. Okay, any other questions before we call it, please?
Can you have a summary, like your last sentence need to summarize?
It's always better to quit sooner rather than later.
Yeah.
You know, in an academic paper, for example, often they want you at the end to tell them what you said. You know? But that's not the case with writing popular nonfiction. Generally, you just get, when you get to the end, stop.
Do you mean to relate it back to anything right in the beginning?
One style of concluding an article is to bring it full circle, you know, and connect it with something you said real early in the article, and that makes for a really nice concluding paragraph. Yeah. And sometimes that's possible to do that, and it's nice. Other times it's not, and you just have to, when you get through with saying everything you've said, then just stop. You don't have to write a summary remark or a summary paragraph or a statement or anything. You just quit. And sometimes that's hard to do. That's kind of something that I had to learn, was to just stop and leave it.
You know? I have advice. I sat in a pew and listened to a clergyman do that to a sermon.
Yeah. Keep going over and over telling you what he said.
He was right there, and then he had to go on for 10 more minutes.
Yeah.
The whole thing.
I'm sure.
What other magazines and books have you written?
Pardon me?
Magazines and books, like I see that one.
Yeah.
Magazines have you written?
Well, most of the national level Catholic magazines and newspapers, U.S. Catholic, the National Catholic Reporter, there's a weekly in Indiana called Our Sunday Visitor. Trying to think of others. There's a lot of them. I can't remember them all right now.
Yeah.
But, I had a piece in the National Catholic Reporter a couple of weeks ago about my grandmother. You know, and this is a very wild-eyed, left-leaning, liberally, you know, wild-eyed liberal publication. And yet they ran this little piece about my grandmother, which I thought was amusing. Anyway, thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good luck in your writing.